Stay safe on the roads with Rain-X Vision Beam Wiper Blades, now at Menards. For over 40 years, Rain-X has provided drivers with products to outsmart the elements. Their Vision Beam Wiper Blades are easy to install and are designed to provide a smooth, streak-free wipe every time. Save big money on all Rain-X products now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Donna Adelson, there's so much to discuss in this case, and there's so many legal questions I think a lot of us are starting to stack our list with, because it's getting more dicey, it's getting more questionable, it's getting more obvious the guilt of Donna Adelson, let's be honest. But I want to start with something in this next conversation that I really think cuts through this first week and a half of testimony: the family. We've now seen Donna and her own children take the stand. Robert came across blunt, detached, almost clinical in how he described his mother's control. Wendy, on the other hand, was evasive, giving jurors a steady diet of, "I don't remember." Instead of showing family unity, it exposed a lot of cracks. Estrangement, discomfort, resentment. It's not a good look for the defendant who's trying to project a warm, grandmotherly image. Unfortunately, no cardigan can bring that to the jurors. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, joining me to discuss. Eric, let's just start out with all of this. What kind of impact does it have when jurors hear children describe their parent, the defendant, as they've heard her described, like controlling? Let's start with that.
Yeah, I mean, who knows an individual better in the vast majority of circumstances but the children? You know, they grew up with this person. They've seen them over the course of years and years, watched their conduct. They know the family dynamic. They know what their mom's like, you know? And so in this case, the prosecution's theme is essentially that Donna had her hands in all of this, that she was intimately involved in the child custody issue. And those themes were kind of corroborated by what the children had said.
Very, very much so. And very, very clearly, I would say, as well. How do you think jurors are weighing, in contrast, Robert's kind of, you know, matter of fact answers against Wendy's kind of foggy, more, "I don't remember" hesitancy with her Botoxed eyebrows?
Yeah, you know, certainly the jury is taking it all in, and you have kind of contrasting presentations on the stand between Robert and Wendy here. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're going to look at, hey, are one of these kids trying to protect their mom? Do one of these kids kind of not care and are just kind of giving it to the jury straight? You know, and looking at it through that paradigm, the jury might conclude that, hey, Robert, who's been estranged from Donna for some time, he has less of an interest to protect his mom. He's more likely to just kind of come with it and give the straight facts to this jury. So I wonder if they're giving more credibility to sort of how he described things.
And I'm wondering how they read to the jury, and I'm curious to get your perspective, you know, as a former prosecutor, as a defense attorney, where you have, you know, the combination of the two. You got the one being more evasive, you got the one being more direct. Is Wendy's evasiveness, I mean, does that help mom? Does it hurt Donna by making the whole thing look even shadier? Because they're both coming across, at least with a level of shadiness about mom, one a little more direct and extreme, the other one like, "Well, I don't want to say anything too bad."
Yeah, it's certainly projects not the greatest look for Donna there. It looks suspicious. It looks shady, like you said. On the other hand, you know, this case it relies on a lot of circumstantial evidence, and Wendy did not provide anything overly direct or substantive that incriminates Donna, in my opinion. And so while it might not be the best look, it also doesn't add to the prosecution and what they need to meet their burden.
But it also went to the character of Donna Adelson. And I think that's a big part of all understanding Donna Adelson, not just circumstantial evidence, but understanding the character. And if the jury understands people at all, they'll know if something is a big divergent from their normal line of actions. And it seems Donna consistently was out there all the time talking about the problem, the big problem being Dan Markell. No matter what it was, it seemed like there was no filter on Donna most of the time. So could we do this? Could we do that? Could we get the money? Could we hire a hitman? I mean, it sounds like it was just this throw up of all of these ideas. And then if you're reading it together, you hear Wendy later talking to, an ex-boyfriend that my brother looked into all options. Sounds like Charlie took the hint that, Donna was suffering and we had to help Donna. We had to fix this for Donna more than anyone else because she couldn't sleep at night, this and that. And that he literally took that, just bleh of everything and seeked everything out. That's some disturbing stuff there that anyone went that far.
Oh, sure. I mean, the picture painted of Donna Adelson so far is not only someone who is hyper invested in this child custody dispute, but someone who's willing to go to great lengths to get the outcome that she wanted with respect to this child custody dispute. We talk about offers of like $1 million. Like, mm-hmm. Who has that? And who is willing to put that up just to get sort of a child custody arrangement that they want? Donna Adelson is the answer. Then on top of that, the communications with Charlie Adelson, those are beginning to come out as well. And not a good look, certainly something that goes to motive for Donna Adelson.
Yeah, we'll start talking more about Charlie and what we're learning from some of the exes in just a little bit. The defense even tried to subpoena Wendy to testify for them. And then that kind of didn't happen. We've also learned that Wendy hasn't talked to mom since 2023, since the verdict came down for Charlie. The fact that they tried to get Wendy to testify via subpoena, is that desperation? I mean, how does that play in a jury's mind?
If the jury hears about that, what it shows is that Wendy was not cooperative with the defense. Because if on the defense side, if you have a witness you want to call and they're cooperative, you don't have to subpoena them. You just say, hey, can you please show up at court at this time and come help us out? It sounds like more was required to get Wendy to get there. And in fact, now she's been called as a witness for the prosecution. So obviously some dissension within this family that has clearly fallen apart after this murder for hire plot and Dan Markell's untimely death.
What was your reaction when you heard that they hadn't spoken since 2023?
Look at the timing on that. I mean, that is curious, isn't it? Like, if they had a decent relationship up until then, why 2023? Oh, that's the time where the brother Charlie was convicted of murder. And so what it suggests perhaps is that Wendy sort of saw the writing on the wall, saw that Donna might be next, did not want to get herself, Wendy, involved in some kind of criminal liability and decided to distance herself from any potential criminal actors in this sort of incestuous murder for hire plot.
And that's probably at an attorney's advisement, I would think. I mean, her attorney's obviously the one that struck back and said, yeah, you're not going to go and testify. Let's talk about the immunity that she has here in this, because, she did go up and testify. I don't think she necessarily revealed a whole lot that would go against her. I would say some of the testimony from other people doesn't look all that good about Wendy. But what does it mean where she has that impartial immunity from what she said on the stand?
So what that means, Tony, is that the prosecution thinks her testimony was valuable enough that they're saying, hey, you get up there and tell the truth and whatever comes out, we're not going to prosecute you for it. And so oftentimes what that results in is really incriminating testimony from the witness because they know they're not going to get in trouble for saying it. Here, that wasn't really how Wendy played it. And there's at least a chance that if Wendy held back or was not truthful on the stand, that immunity could be pulled and Wendy could be in the crosshairs at some point down the road.
Her main theme seemed to be, I don't remember. Is that lying by omission? Is that by omission? I mean, is there anything that she did up there by not being truthful? I mean, I don't remember was the big thing. I find that hard to believe. These are the biggest moments in your life and you seem to be clueless on them. But again, you know, she doesn't want to incriminate herself. She doesn't have to incriminate herself. But the I don't remember remarks, was there too much of that? Or was that, did she play that card right?
Well, I think if you're the defense, you think she played that card right. In terms of saying, I don't remember, it's hard to show that that's a lie because you got to get inside somebody's head. And, you know, perhaps they would say, oh, yeah, I recalled this fact 2 weeks ago, but I was on the stand, I was nervous and whatever, and I didn't remember. That being said, the prosecution can look into digital forensics. They can look into evidence that they have from witnesses. You know, for example, if Wendy relayed facts about the case, you know, recent in time to her testimony, then got on the stand and said, I didn't remember. That gives rise to the specter that, hey, you're just kind of fibbing up there trying to protect somebody and you're not being completely forthcoming here.
How do you think it read to the jury, the I don't remembers? Because that I'm going to go with not forthcoming. Again, if you just look at the situation, this is where the father of her children died. These are key moments in your life. This is stuff that's going to be ingrained forever. And you're like, I don't remember if they have the McRib back at McDonald's this month or not, as if it's something that lighthearted. We're talking about murder, your children's father being gone away, your brother conspiring. You don't remember any of this? I mean, one could say it's trauma and it's blocked out, but I don't think I buy it. I don't think a jury's going to buy it either.
You know, common sense would tell us in many circumstances that these are the very types of facts one would remember. They are overly traumatic. They could be misremembered. There could be perception issues, but you're going to have that in your head. I think when she got up there, it definitely looked like she was protecting her mom. And the jury is going to say, hey, why would she need to do that if the mom did nothing wrong?
From the prosecution side, I mean, how do you use the cracks in this case to argue of Donna's control? And if you're the defense, is there any way to make those fractures look irrelevant or harmless?
You know, I think from the prosecution's perspective, one thing that they could do is you got Whitney's testimony saying, or Wendy's testimony saying, I don't remember, I don't remember. And then you have Robert's testimony saying how controlling Donna was. Even though there had been an alleged lapse in communication between Wendy and Donna, the prosecution can argue in closing that, hey, this was textbook of how this family dynamic works. And Donna is sort of at the helm and you're not going to cross her and you're not going to say anything that's going to be problematic for her. And that's exactly what Wendy did because she's trying to protect her mother and hiding information that could be incriminating. That's how the prosecution's going to play it. Defense is going to play it like, hey, I don't remember is an absence of evidence. Got an absence of evidence. You have reasonable doubt.
Is it wise at this point for Wendy to be protecting mom? I mean, she has immunity up there to say, I mean, she could say she did it. I know mom did it. Whatever. She could say anything she wants. I mean, she could even say, well, could she say that she knew about it? If she were to go on their stand right now with this immunity and say, I did know that they were plotting something. I never in my wildest dreams thought that they'd go kill him. I thought maybe they were going to intimidate this or that. I was fearful that they could have done this, and it looks like they did. Could she go say that right now? And would she still have immunity?
She could, and assuming that this is kind of a standard immunity agreement, she would. She could get up there and give all of the details, spill the beans on what she knows, and Wendy would not be prosecuted for that, assuming that it was in compliance with that immunity agreement. And so, you know, Wendy's no saint herself. There's been some stuff come out in terms of how hostile she was to Dan as well. And so she's not, you know, a little saint in this either.
Not at all. But if she, with the immunity right now, couldn't, I mean, obviously her turn on the stand is over, but could she have really used that more to her advantage and really just spilled everything if in fact she knows more? Again, that's the assumption. We don't know. She's never been charged with anything, all allegedly. Let's say she does know more, but not to the level of I ordered the hit. But just you're aware, like we were saying, if she got that stuff out now, wouldn't that protect her then more later if this is all just kind of out of the ether and we don't know? But if she threw it out there in that window where she was immune, they couldn't go back and prosecute her on it because she let it out in that window of time. If it comes out in a different window of time, that's new evidence, is it not?
Correct. So the immunity agreements usually only pertain to the testimony being given. It's not anything that happens in the future. And so you bring up a good point, Tony, because if she did hold back, if she does know more, and if there is further evidence that is revealed during an investigation or dependency of the trial, even that cuts against Wendy's claim that she doesn't know what happened, then yeah, she could be totally in the crosshairs, and that could be the next Adelson, who is on the chopping block.
There's a difference between I don't know and I don't remember. Is there not?
There certainly is. And I don't remember is harder to disprove. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, you got to get in the person's head and, you know, perhaps they claim, hey, it was an honest mistake. I knew this information at some point, but on the stand, I freaked out. It's nervous. I'm being peppered with questions. I forgot. And I don't remember is harder to disprove.
Yeah, it is. Let's turn to the money, because this is where prosecutors have been hammering hardest. We've learned Kate McBona was suddenly on the Adelson Institute. I love the pretentiousness of the name, Adelson Institute for the dental practice. Like, it's a payroll. She was on the payroll after the murder. 44 paychecks, every single one personally signed by Donna. And then almost on cue, the payment stopped right after the FBI's undercover sting. Jurors didn't need much imagination to connect those dots. How powerful is it for the jury to see Donna's signature on 44 checks tied directly to the middlewoman who does not work for the dental practice, who on the stand said, I never worked for them. I was even getting a boob job while I was on this payroll, so I couldn't have been possibly working at that time in this murder.
That paper trail is, I think, perhaps the most damning part of this case against Donna Adelson, because how do you explain that away, that this person didn't work for the Adelson Institute, this exalted dentistry empire? You know, she wasn't providing any services for them. And so for what was she being paid? Well, the only connection of which we're aware is her role as an intermediary in this murder for hire plot. So, it, like you said, doesn't take a lot to connect those dots. And I'm not sure how the defense is going to explain that away.
How do you think they were thinking that they would explain this away? Or do you think they just thought they weren't going to get caught?
You know, it's a little hard to say. I'm wondering if in closing argument, they're going to say something like, hey, this was Charlie's mistress at the time, and Charlie wanted us to take care of her. Donna wanted to do what her son wanted. And Donna was just trying to be like a nice mother. They had some money. And so let's take care of the mistress. You know, is that going to pass the smell test of this jury? I'm not so sure.
It sounds like an even worse plot than most Hallmark movies, you know, where like there's the cheating evil man, maybe Lifetime. We should go more Lifetime than Hallmark, you know, where it's like, oh, because it doesn't make any sense at all. It's not like it was like they were together and they're somehow like, well, we can get more of a write-off on the business if we have more people on payroll or something. They weren't even together through most of the time that she's getting paid. It just, and especially the 2-year pattern, 44 checks, my God. And the timing, the checks stopping immediately after the FBI bump. How significant is that in terms of showcasing consciousness of guilt?
You know, the timing in this case is huge. There are a number of events. One is exactly what you just said, where, oh, now we learn that there is this very serious criminal investigation into a murder. Oh, let's stop paying the intermediary who helped us plot this. That's obviously problematic. And then Wendy Adelson, the sister, stopping talking to her mom, Donna Adelson, in 2023, right after the conviction of Charlie Adelson. And then lastly, the timing of Donna Adelson trying to skedaddle out of the country once things started to heat up. I think timing is a big part of this.
There's a lot of tea leaves to be read in this case. They're pretty obvious, but I mean, we do these things, we talk about these things on a regular basis. So they stand out to us like huge red flags, not red herrings. Do you think the jurors are going to buy the idea that Donna was just a bookkeeper and just, you know, well, another check came across the desk and Charlie said to sign it. I'm just doing that. I'm rubber stamping everything. They said she personally signed them. So it wasn't the person at the front desk with a, all right, stamp the name on. We're done. She's looking at these things. The Institute, not that big of an institute, enough where you're going to be looking at the checks. And if you're, you know, thousands of dollars are going out the door to a random human being, Charlie's ex-girlfriend, one would think that there might be a red flag. Will the jury buy it that she was just clueless?
Some very suspicious activity, no question. I think the defense is going to style it as, hey, this is a grandmother who was, you know, just processing financial stuff for this company. She wasn't intimately familiar with where everything was going. And hey, if you want to charge her with fraud or check fraud or wire fraud, something like that, do that. But that's not what they charged her with. And so I think the defense is going to style it in some fashion like that. But that paper trail is very problematic, and the jurors are going to have to look at that in a comprehensive view with all of the other evidence as well.
Yeah, I mean, in conjunction, the two are really strong. If you just had one over here, circumstantial, one over here, you got two colliding here. And when you weigh the paper trail against the live testimony, the live show that's being put on in front of us, is it actually stronger because it feels more objective because the two do seem to tie together so neatly, or does it need the testimony context for it to hit home?
I think that the testimony part is really important because, like you said, these facts in isolation are not dispositive. They're not going to win the day. But when you bring everything together, in fact, the jury is going to be instructed that they have to review the evidence, the totality of evidence, not just one little piece in isolation and say, oh, that's not enough. This little piece, that's not enough. They've got to look at everything. That's going to be their duty as jurors back there. And when you take the witness testimony with the paper trail, and we're going to hear about wiretaps and other communications as well, things are beginning to mount against Donna Adelson.
There's a lot mounting against Donna Adelson, and beyond the financial trail, prosecutors are pointing to Donna's own behavior, what they call the proof of consciousness of guilt. Kate McBonough, this is the go-between, the one who was getting all the checks, testified that Charlie told her, "My mom washed the money," literally, after cash bundles came back damp and molding. And then after Charlie's conviction, Donna buys a one-way ticket to Vietnam, a non-extradition country. The state says those aren't coincidences. They're cover-up and flight. I mean, how pervasive is testimony that places Donna Hands literally on the cash payoff with an ice bottle of Tide with bleach?
You know, it's certainly problematic, and it allegedly came from the mouth of Donna Adelson's son, Charlie, who's already been convicted for being a part of murdering Dan Markell. This is another direct connection related to the financial piece of this murder for hire plot that implicates Donna Adelson. And then you look at the attempt to go to Vietnam, which is a non-extraditable country. There aren't a ton of those. That's one of them. All of those things begin to look like, wow, she saw the writing on the wall and she was trying to get out of Dodge and they stopped her at the last minute.
You've been doing this for a while. Have you ever had a client or heard of anyone, any colleagues, where someone has literally put money in the washing machine to launder it?
That part is very peculiar. I've literally never heard of that happening. You know, what was the purpose of that? To try to remove fingerprints, to try to remove DNA? It just seems like amateur hour a little bit. If you're talking about sophisticated criminals, they're probably going to chuckle if someone suggested that. And so I thought that was kind of a bizarre piece of evidence. And but suspicious, clearly. Like, why would anyone do that?
That's what makes me wonder. And I almost wonder if that is could be used as a piece of evidence to show that there wasn't greater conspiracy with some members of the family, just because of how ludicrous it is. Like, was this Charlie and Donna, and they're doing this together, the two of them, they're going to protect Wendy, they're going to do what they feel is right, they're so enmeshed and connected. I mean, if you just think of it, if Donna had said to anyone, even to Charlie, like, I'm wondering if she just, I'm a laundered, okay, I'll get the money laundered and then I'll bring it to you, Charlie. That seems to be how it went. Even if she said it to Charlie and said, I'm going to put it in the washing machine, I would think even Charlie would have said, what, that's not what that is. But it doesn't seem she said a word to anybody, just went about and did it, which makes you wonder just how isolated was Donna in her carrying out of all of this, if in fact she's guilty of these things, that all this happened really in a vacuum. Didn't ask Wendy, didn't ask Harvey, didn't ask Charlie, just doing her own beeline to the washer.
You know, I the jury's going to draw upon their own common sense and their own experience in interpreting what these alleged acts mean. And so, you know, I've given money to family and friends and whatever, and zero times have I ever put that money in the washing machine or underwater or anything like that. So the jury's going to look at that and say, hey, did Donna Addison just take like the money laundering term literally? And idiotically and put this money underwater? And if so, the only reason a person would do that would be to kind of cover up some misdeeds.
Yeah. I mean, or you watched too much CSI or something and didn't pay much attention and really thought, oh, well, I launder money. I think I know how to do that. And you've had this in your mind and let's go launder the money. I mean, could the defense get any traction with the idea that Charlie just invoked his mom's name in this, maybe even to protect himself rather than Donna actually handling the money?
100%. And I think the defense absolutely needs to go that route. Because look, we have some primary actors in this case who have already been convicted. We have the gunman. We have the two gang members who carried out the hit. We have the intermediary, Kate, who has already been convicted. Charlie, already been convicted. That is the direction to which Don Adelson's counsel needs to point and say, hey, look, these are the folks who are directly involved, and whatever they said about their mom, about Charlie's mom, was just to sort of get some heat off of them, when clearly a jury has already said they've done it.
Damp molding bills are a strange detail, no matter any way you slice it, and including stapled together. Who staples money together, especially washed money? Let's get the stapler out. That's going to stick with jurors. But is it going to stick with them because it's so absurd? And one would think this couldn't possibly have happened. It sounds like Charlie's making up a story to get his mom involved and take the blame off of him. Or does it just show, along with the other things that Donna has allegedly proposed for solutions to the Danny problem, as being pretty much right in line with other ridiculous ideas that don't seem to have a second thought to them?
You know, in fairness, in watching the Charlie Adelson trial in which he was convicted, he's not the most smooth operator either. He's not a sophisticated criminal. He made a ton of missteps. He incriminated himself multiple times during the investigation and on the stand. And so can an argument be made that this is just Charlie Adelson, you know, stepping in it yet again in some haphazard attempt to try and avoid criminal liability, and to do so, he had to implicate somebody else? Certainly that argument can be made, and perhaps a jury might be receptive to it just based on how ridiculous this claim is regarding this washed and wet and moldy money.
Yeah, in the Vietnam trip, one way. No extradition, her and Harvey getting stopped at the airport. How do you think the jury's going to read that kind of move? Is she going to be able, or are they going to be able to sell it off as, well, we needed some time away. Our son was just convicted of murder. Our son, this has been a horrible family, just a nightmare. And we need some time away. I could see needing that. If this is what's going on in your family, if you had nothing to do with it, I'd be wanting to get out of Dodge too. And just, I need some time. I need some space to think about life. One could make that argument. One may want a return ticket. One may think this may look a little bit suspicious should you be stopped. Again, I don't know that there was the thinking process going on here that you might be stopped. And how will this look? There wasn't usually a plan B in a lot of these cases. It just seems to be a lot of instinct, a lot of reaction, and not a lot of planning for the possible turnoffs that may occur in this case.
Oh, totally. And I think that that's one way the defense might style it. They might say, hey, look, Donna Adelson's not a criminal. She's not this mastermind who's making these brilliant moves during the pendency of this whole saga. She wants to get out of town due to this family tragedy. You know, perhaps they even argue that, hey, you know, maybe she saw some heat coming her way and she was scared. And she, and an innocent person who thinks they're going to be railroaded for something they didn't do, that would be an equally plausible motivation to leave that area. And that's an innocent motivation. And so I think that the defense has some outs in terms of how they play it in closing.
We're not hearing a whole hell of a lot on cross from the defense of Donna Adelson where these specific arguments that we're theorizing could be made. I mean, yes, they still have their turn to go. Maybe they're just saving it all for them. But are they missing opportunities? Is Donna Adelson's doppelganger attorney really missing some opportunities here to shout of Donna's innocence?
You know, I think that there were some missed opportunities, yes. I think defense has to be cautious. You got to be careful because sometimes less is more. Keep in mind, prosecution has the burden. And so you don't want to go down some road that turns out to have a landmine and blows up in your face, and now your case is worse. And so perhaps they're just being very cautious, I think overly cautious. I think they've got to come with it a little more in terms of presenting their theory, presenting their theme, but you know, you don't want to overdo it either.
That's true. I mean, we've seen a lot of cases recently where the prosecution goes and a lot of folks think they nailed it. It's going to be going down, and then they don't present any sort of defense, and guess who wins? The defense. I'm wondering if that's, I don't know that it's going to play out that way here, but I'm wondering if that's how they're thinking right now.
Very well could be, but usually in those cases, my appraisal is that defense scores points. They score points in cross-examination. They score points in the prosecution's case in chief. You know, you don't want to do any damage, but you got to go on the offensive a little bit out there. And in my review, they haven't scored a ton of points yet in terms of bringing up stuff they could have brought up, especially with that intermediary gate. There's a lot that they could have done to make her look horrible, like this murder for hire plot intermediary. And I feel like they held back a bit on it.
We get to the big question on this. Was Donna the mastermind of all this? The state's theory is that her obsession with keeping the grandkids close drove everything. And we're hearing more evidence of it, not just of them wanting or her wanting the kids moved closer to them, but by the way which she got that done. The manipulation, if we're to believe Catherine McBonough's testimony about Charlie, mom's really upset, she can't sleep, we got to do something, trying to come to her rescue. I mean, we've seen emails pressuring Wendy during custody battles, and Kate says Charlie would step out mid-planning calls to consult his mom. Prosecutors want jurors to see her as the architect. The defense, meanwhile, trying to paint her as that overbearing but non-criminal mother caught in Charlie's orbit. That distinction could decide her fate. How central is the grandchildren motive in trying or in tying Donna to the orchestration of this whole murder?
Well, I think it's critically important because the prosecution has really committed to it. They've kind of, in a roundabout way, made a promise to this jury that, hey, we're going to show you how she was the architect, how she was the orchestrator. And that's a tall order. We're talking about a woman in her 70s, and you're trying to say that this woman who's, you know, the bookkeeper at a dental practice had this law professor killed by the Latin Kings gang members. That's a tall order. That's going to be a hard sell. They got to come with it. And I think you know, Donna is certainly going to kind of play the sympathetic old grandma here. And I think the truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
Should Donna have played my faculties are failing. Look how crazy this is. I thought I should wash money. And that was 11 years ago. I am failing in the brain. And that this is just the work of someone who is deteriorating mentally, and their faculties are not what they should be. And dots are connecting in weird places.
It's a common theme, Tony, and we've seen it before. We've seen it in a somewhat different way in the Robert Durst case, where he, mm-hmm. you know, is carted into the trial, and he's got, you know, he's talking about the catheter he's got. He's got hooked up to machines and stuff. They want to make him look like a sympathetic old man who didn't really know what he was doing, and certainly that is a road that they could have gone. Now, in some of these communications, Donna sounds pretty lucid. She sounds pretty coherent. Sounds pretty much like she knows what she's doing, at least according to some. So I'm not sure how much they're going to go down that road. Could have been something to explore, but defense ain't doing a whole lot.
Yeah, I think they've already picked their road. Lucid, but loose cannon. I would say at the same time. I mean, how pervasive is the testimony that Charlie consulted her repeatedly during the planning of the hit with Catherine McBonner? They're going through the conversation. Okay, now I got this, my friend who can do this, or my ex who could do this or that. Hang on, let me go call mom quick. Hey, mom, they said they can do this. Does this sound like a... Okay, mom says it's okay. Okay, that we could do that. Let me call mom real quick. I mean, I'm guessing this probably occurs more than just when they're planning murder. Probably, you know, when they go to Applebee's. What flavor do you want on those wings? Okay, Charlie, we will get you the buffalo. Do you want ranch or right. blue cheese? Okay. I'm guessing it might go down to that level, considering how much we're learning about how much planning Donna still did for her adult son most of her life. But that is some strong testimony from Catherine McBonner.
Oh, without question. And, you know, I think there are multiple interpretations. The prosecution's interpretation is, look, he was looping her in every step of the way because she was directly involved. She was involved financially. She was involved in terms of motive. And she wanted to be the sort of controlling, overbearing force and make sure that the deed got done. The other interpretation is, you know, I'm a mama's boy. And when things happen in my life, a lot of times I call my mom, man. And you know, I think that the defense can play that to the jury and say, hey, when you've got this child custody thing going on within the family, it's Charlie's sister, it's Donna's daughter. You know, they're close knit and they're talking about it. And talking about it is not a crime. Or, you know, talking about the trials and tribulations of family drama is not a crime.
But she's testifying that he's calling her while they're arranging the hit. That's the difference. I mean, how strong of an argument? I think the only argument, I mean, you tell me if I'm wrong, is that they're going to try and paint Catherine McBonner as an unreliable witness. She's in prison. She's a liar. She did this. She did that. I mean, she really has no reason to lie about any of this anymore, other than for a get out of jail for a day free card. Do you think that they can successfully argue this to a jury that she's not a reliable witness, or did she come across pretty credible?
You know, one thing that the defense cannot argue forcefully, I think, is some kind of immunity deal, because Kate, the intermediary, doesn't have that. She's sentenced to prison. She's going to be in there for decades and decades. And even if she was vying for some kind of benefit, like you said, that benefit's going to be something trivial. It's going to be, you know, possibly, you know, one day out for a family funeral or something. It's not going to be, you know, we're going to take 15 years off your sentence. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to be hard to cast her how the defense wants to cast her. That being said, she's been convicted being an intermediary in a murder for hire plot. She was a mistress at one point. She is involved with the Latin Kings gang. There are some shady aspects to her as well.
There's shady aspects, but those shady aspects prove her connection to being able to pull all this off. Obviously, the fact that she's in prison for it also proves that she was able to pull it off. Does the prosecution need to prove that Donna was the mastermind of all this, or just that she knowingly helped facilitate the crime, just had the conversations, never said to Charlie, go do the hit on this day, but just here's all these ideas. And she could, I never thought we would do it. I was just saying these things in hate and in angst and in all that. I didn't mean for someone to go kill him, you know, the same way, you know, basically the same defense that Wendy throws out there.
You bring up an important point, Tony, because the prosecution can sometimes overcommit. They can overpromise. They can say, hey, look, she was the orchestrator. She was the mastermind, the architect behind all of this. But that's not the legal standard. The legal standard, essentially, is that Donna Adelson knew what was going to happen, wanted it to happen, had the mental state that she wanted it to happen, and provided an act in furtherance for that to happen. That's it. It doesn't mean that she needs to be sort of the maestro behind the scenes, conducting all of this. And I'll note that Charlie Adelson's license plate actually says maestro. And so I bet the defense is going to bring that up in combating this theme from the prosecution that Donna's the mastermind.
It almost feels a little bit like Charlie wanted to be Donna, like he's the mini Donna, the Donna in training in some weird Norman Bates-ish sort of way that doesn't involve, you know, that. But who knows? I mean, I guess anything's possible here with the Adelson family. If the jurors buy the mastermind narrative, I mean, how is that going to look when it comes to sentencing? What kind of stake does that hold?
Oh, gosh. I mean, when, as a judge, when you have a case involving multiple alleged culprits, the judge is always trying to determine who's more blameworthy, who's more culpable, who deserves the most punishment, and who might deserve less. And so when we're talking about a case like this, the head honcho, the one at the top, the one who's calling the shots, you better believe that that person is going to be the most blameworthy if convicted. And so the judge is going to take that into consideration. And if she is convicted, the judge is going to bring down the hammer.
Wendy's ex-boyfriend took the stand. And I thought, said a lot of damning things more about Wendy than Donna, actually, when it came to talking about suspicion of her knowledge of this, canceling that trip, that vacation right before, because she was worried about not being able to pick up the kids from school, like, 48 hours basically after the plane landed, the next day at 5 o'clock. They were coming in early the day prior, but it was the specific day that Danny was murdered. There was a lot of question, and then the questions about, oh, where are you going to be at this point in time in your day? Almost, if you read the tea leaves, hinting at, well, were they searching for someone to pin a blame on here? This jealous boyfriend going and killing her ex out of rage, which obviously this man just seems like the last thing next to a killer. Is Wendy next? Is the question. Is Wendy next? I mean, are we seeing more dominoes falling here? I know she's got the immunity with her testimony, but the other testimony does not look very favorable to Wendy. And we've seen them kind of pick them off one by one as these trials have gone on.
Yeah, one thing to keep in mind about immunity is that it's limited in scope. So what essentially it means, I believe, in this case, is that anything Wendy says on the stand can't be used against her. But that doesn't go for what other people say on the stand. Yeah. That doesn't go for investigations that are peripheral and going on outside of that courtroom. And yes, I think my interpretation of the boyfriend's testimony was that Wendy may have been trying to kind of put this on him. And in fact, my understanding is that the killers may have used a vehicle that was substantially similar to the boyfriend's vehicle as an added measure to try to place the blame on him. So the cards have fallen one by one of the Adelson family, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see charges coming down for Wendy at some point.
Would they have already charged Wendy, or what is there a strategy to this? Does it make sense, just like Donna wasn't charged right away? I mean, they had a lot of information already, or is there a piece here? Is there a chunk of information that they're hoping to glean out of this trial that adds that extra block to the Jenga tower that says, yes, we can now charge Wendy?
Well, keep in mind, I mean, this case, the killing itself happened more than 10 years ago. And so this has been a slow play the entire time. Donna wasn't immediately charged. And so the fact that she hasn't been charged yet is no guarantee that she would not be charged. And in fact, during these trials, what the prosecution is getting is they are getting sworn testimony under oath, not just a witness statement that you go to, you know, cop goes to somebody's house, get some information. No, this is sworn testimony under oath from these witnesses. That is compelling and valuable, and that couldn't help the prosecution meet their burden of probable cause to charge somebody. It can help them meet their burden later on at trial, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And so the fact that they're still accumulating evidence is not uncommon, and Wendy's not out of the woods.
What about Harvey? We don't hear much about Harvey in any of this other than he was at the airport with a ticket. We don't hear him intertwined like we do Wendy or Charlie, or he's there. He seems to be the passive guy that was the perfect, you know, husband for someone like Donna Adelson, or captive slave, however you'd like to look at it. It doesn't seem to look very good, but do you think that he has any chance of being charged in any of this, or would he have already been charged with Donna simultaneously?
I'm wondering if they thought they had evidence of parental involvement. So clearly Donna, they've charged her. It would make sense to charge both parents at the same time. You know, maybe they're waiting to see if Donna's going to testify, which she said that she is. and maybe they're going to ask about Harvey in there. Maybe they're going to get some sworn testimony regarding Harvey. I don't know. But I just haven't read reports that implicate him nearly as directly and compellingly as some of the other agents.
I almost forgot about Donna saying that she's going to testify, because these early witnesses have been so interesting and so compelling. Do you think the obviously speculation by the time people may be watching this and whatnot, we may already be into the defense side of things. Do you think Donna's going to be the only witness for the defense, or is there going to be others? Is Donna just going to go up there and she thinks she's going to correct the story, change the narrative, calm everybody down, bake a couple cookies, have some Sharkleberry Finn Kool-Aid, watch some after-school TV specials, and call it a day?
Well, how wholesome that sounds. But, you know, would that be consistent with someone who's been described as controlling, someone who is sort of overbearing, who wants to have their hand in everything and make sure that they're able to convey what they want to convey? Certainly is. And so then she could seal her own fate up there. We saw that with Charlie Adelson, who couldn't resist testifying. And now he's in a box for the rest of his life.
Well, I sure hope she continues to not be able to resist. That's going to be a fun day. Eric Faddis, defense attorney, former prosecutor, as always, thank you so much for coming on and giving us your insight on all of these crazy cases. Very much appreciated. You guys, let me know in the comments what your thoughts are on this case on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us. Make that same search wherever you download podcasts as well, so you don't miss any of our coverage and this and the many cases we got for you right here at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.